and help us to apply it to our daily lives. We're so thankful that you sent your son Jesus to be that perfect sacrifice, dying on that cross of Calvary, so that we might have a way to have our sins forgiven. We just ask you for those who could not be here tonight, that you might comfort and heal those that are in pain and sick, and be with those that are traveling. We just ask now that you be with Daniel and the rest of us as we study this evening. Pray this in Jesus' holy name. Amen.
All right, we're finishing up Luke chapter 9, starting with the Transfiguration in verse 28. It's called the Transfiguration in Luke chapter 9 because of the... It's called the Transfiguration in Matthew chapter 17. But Matthew uses the word transform that Luke doesn't use, but it's still called the Transfiguration because that's what happens. Luke uses an idea in verse 29. While he was praying, the appearance of his face became different. Now, notice the limitations that Luke puts on the Transfiguration. What's the limit? The limit of the Transfiguration. Luke puts a limit onto it. We have a whole body. Jesus had a whole body.
White and gleaming.
No.
That it limits it to his face.
Limits it to his face. When we think of the Transfiguration, what do we think of? His whole body. But Luke makes a point to notice that it was just his face. Now, I didn't notice that, honestly, until just now. So I don't know if Matthew or Mark point that out. Somebody, let's pick on Solomon, and let's pick on Lorna. Solomon, you look up Matthew 17. If Matthew limits it to the face, Lorna, you look up Mark. I think it's in Mark, 6, 8, or 9.
I don't read, right?
Yeah, I know you, I know you read in
nine.
Whatever it was. Mark 9, thank you. While the rest of us are going to keep looking at this, but then, so the appearance of his face became different, and that just means it became different. Like, there's really nothing special about that word, but it became different. There was something different about his face than it was before. So that's important. It doesn't transform necessarily, like how Matthew says it, but it could have transformed because it says it became something different. Don't know. Yes?
James, King James doesn't say his face.
Doesn't?
No, that you're reading 29?
Uh-huh.
It says, and as he prayed, the fashion of his countenance.
Well, countenance is the face.
Yeah.
Well, it can be the whole thing, too. The countenance of the actions and whatever.
Yeah, but King James English is kind of... Anyway,
I'm looking all over the place for face.
Yeah, it could mean face, yeah. Okay, who had... Solomon?
Yeah, Matthew said his face.
Matthew says his face.
Yeah.
Ooh. Mark?
Mark says his garments became radiant and exceedingly white, and no launderer on earth could whiten it.
So Matthew and Luke point out the face transformed or became different. That's interesting. All right, moving on. But also his clothing becomes white and gleaming. So that's an important thing, right? And then two men, who?
Moses and Elijah.
Moses and Elijah, how do they appear?
In glory.
In glory. What does that mean?
Would there be a glow or a shininess to it?
It'd stand out somewhere.
Like how Moses appeared in the Old Testament, they have to put a veil on him, maybe?
Yeah.
Over what part of him?
His face.
His face.
Yeah, that's true.
But they appeared in glory.
Heaven.
That could be the whole body.
Well, they weren't coming from heaven, though. Where were they coming from?
Sheol.
Hades, paradise, Abraham's bosom. Which makes them what?
Ghost.
There's Moses and Elijah standing next to Jesus. And there they are. I mean, Samuel came up from Hades. So, Moses and Elijah, what do? They just stand there, yay, Jesus. Is that what they do? They're speaking to him about what? About his what?
His decease.
His decease?
Mine says departure.
Departure? His decease, that's weird. What?
Mine says decease.
Oh, are you using King James too?
No, New American.
New King James.
Says decease.
What does it say? No, it doesn't.
New King James.
Or New King James.
New King James, okay. So they're talking about his departure or his decease or his dying, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. So this is important. So let's skip from here and let's go to the near the end of the chapter, verses 51 through 56. Someone please read those.
And it came about when the days were approaching for his ascension that he resolutely set his face to go to Jerusalem.
Pause. What did we just read about the conversation between Jesus, Moses, and Elijah?
That's where he's going to die.
And when and where? Why?
It must be accomplished.
Where?
At Jerusalem.
At Jerusalem. So now all of a sudden he's determined to go to where? Because the days of his ascension, the days of his departure are coming. So he's determined. Well, he just had a conversation with Moses and Elijah about that very thing. Continue on to verse 52.
And he sent messengers on ahead of him, and they went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for him. And they did not receive him because he was journeying with his face towards Jerusalem. And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But he turned and rebuked them and said, you do not know what kind of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went on to another village.
He's determined to go to Jerusalem. Why? Right, which implies, when is this?
Getting near the end.
Getting near that point. How near that point?
Must be days.
Could be days, probably more like weeks. Could be months. We don't know. The point is, he knows the time's coming.
Right.
So probably in the... probably after the Jewish New Year, but we don't know. Could have been any time. We just don't know. Passover is in the first month, right? Hello? Passover is in the first month, so this couldn't be after New Year's. It has to be before New Year's. So it has to be after Feast. So we're talking January to February, March, from our perspective, but for them, it'd be the end of their year. We don't know, but he knows it's getting time. He's got to be heading that way. So he sends disciples on ahead of him to prepare the way. What chapter are we in now?
Nine.
How many chapters are in Luke?
Twenty-four.
So 20. When is Jesus crucified? What chapter? And dies. What?
23.
Chapter 23. So how many chapters are we in chapter 9? We're at the end of chapter 9. And then next week, Sunday, is chapter 10. How many chapters until 23. Chapter 23? 13 chapters. So we're already in the Gospel of Luke, from Luke. Okay, let me back up. Luke 1 and 2 are about what? His birth and... What else is in Luke 2?
Being
12 years old. So we go from Luke 2, him being 12 years old, we go to John, Luke 3, we go from Luke 12, where he's Luke 2, where he's 12, to Luke 3, where he's 30-ish, the beginning of his work. We go in 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 7 chapters. Of 3 years of him teaching and working, and we're at the end of chapter 9, And we have 13 chapters of a few months of his last time on earth. It's an interesting time crunch that Luke gives us. And I want to point that out because from everything starting really from verse 57 in Luke 9 through chapter 23, into chapter 23, I guess, are all him going to die. Are all him all going to prepare the 12, prepare himself for what he came to do, to save us all from sin. And that emphasis sort of begins in this chapter. Earlier in chapter 9, we talked about this last week, or on Sunday, I should say. In starting in verse 18 through 22, he asks the disciples, "Who do men say that I am?" And what do they say?
Elijah and John the Baptist.
But who do you say that I am?
The Christ, Son of God.
Christ, Son of God. But then in verse 21, what does he do?
He straightened charged them and commanded them to tell no man.
Don't tell anybody this. But then verse 22, why is he saying that?
Because he must suffer many things.
Uh-huh.
And be rejected of the elders, chief priests,
and
scribes,
and
be killed.
So this is, in Luke's gospel, the first time he really brings that out to the 12, right before Transfiguration, when three of them see him talking to Moses and Elijah, and they're talking to him about that very thing, and now it's, go ahead of me, prepare my way, here we are.
Why does he say that? Why does he say don't tell people?
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe,
we're supposed to tell people.
We are, yes.
No, I know, but that's one of the things that I've never understood.
Paul talks about the mysteries of salvation in Ephesians. It doesn't put it that way, but that's the mystery, is that the Gentiles are fellow heirs, and there's all sorts of things. Peter writes about the prophets who wrote of salvation, desired earnestly, seeking the things they were trying to, they were searching the scriptures to see what they were seeing, because they didn't get it. The Spirit of Christ revealing to them that they were serving us, because we have the fulfillment. The only thing I can think of is has something to do with keeping things mysterious until the fulfillment. Legion. We just saw Legion. Did Legion know who Jesus was?
Yeah, they did.
In Luke 4, Jesus deals with Satan directly. Satan knows who he is. But what does Satan try to do?
Overpower him.
He doesn't try to overpower him.
Lure him
to serve him. Yeah. Which has always struck me funny. Doesn't he know who this guy is?
No. Every change his mind, he never know.
Think about that. If Satan knows really who Jesus is, would he really even bother tempting him with, if you bow down and serve me, I'll give you all these kingdoms?
It's a big ego.
Maybe, or maybe, what we're seeing is a lot more of not everyone knew what was about to happen. In fact, is it the Hebrew writer who says, if the rulers of this world had known that killing Jesus was going to fulfill the plan of God, I'm paraphrasing, then they wouldn't have killed him? And who is it that John says put it into Judas' heart to betray him? So my only guess is this has something to do with the overall theme of God intentionally kept things hidden from everybody so that, because if they knew what was going on, then this wouldn't happen. Patty?
Well, I think that you're right in that. And I think that when we read these scriptures, we already know the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys were getting snippets of it as they went along, and they didn't have the whole picture.
Right.
And Jesus knew they didn't understand the whole thing. And so he's just making sure that they're not going to start talking about something that's not going to really happen, or that's not really what he wants it.
Or they don't truly fully understand.
And they don't fully understand.
Right.
So I think he was just being cautious about what was going to be discussed.
In Matthew 16, when Jesus is talking with the 12, and they say, and Peter says, "You are the Christ, the only God," Matthew says from this time he started telling them he was going to go to Jerusalem to die. So if that's the same time frame, he hasn't been telling them. So now it's, what? You no. Remember Peter says, no, far be it from you, Lord. And Peter said, Jesus says to Satan. Jesus says to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You're putting your focus on man's will, not God's. Again, paraphrasing because the words aren't coming. So there's a lot more going on than what the people can see. And one of the reasons the people can't see it is because God has kept it from people. But what little has been given, they know enough. Well, I mean, look what he's doing. We just saw him calm the sea after taking a nap in it. We've seen him feed 5,000 with 2 or 3 loaves and 5 fishes. We've seen him raise the dead. We've seen him cast out demons. Not just demons, legion. We've seen this. I mean, who else could this guy be but the Christ? But there's still that human element of, who do they think the Christ was supposed to be? They thought, still think, he's supposed to be a political figure who's going to come and restore Israel to rule the world. That's what they think, thought. And the disciples are, they have that paradigm. So we kind of got to give everybody a break that they're seeing things from a fleshy perspective, because that's the perspective they were taught. And Jesus is trying as patiently as possible, come with me. Come on. I know you're down here, but come up here with me. And part of that is, you think this didn't stick with Peter, James, and John? Peter writes about this in 2 Peter. 2 Peter chapter 1, that no prophecy of Scripture is a matter of own interpretation. Peter begins that little section by talking about this very event, the Transfiguration. So it's stuck with him. All right. Whew. Anyone else? Cool. All right, let's move on. So we're gonna skip a lot of details because we've got a lot more left in chapter 9 that's important. That has to do with the 12, but also with us. So I do want to mention a couple more things about the Transfiguration, though, quickly. In verse 34, or 33 and 34, Peter has that, we'll build 3 tabernacles for one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And in verse 34, while he was saying this, a cloud form began to overshadow them, and they were afraid as they entered the clouds. They're walking along, and Peter's, hey, let's build 3 tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses. And as he's saying that, there's this cloud going to surround them. And one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. What's going on? And then one of the most amazing things happened. Says what? This is my beloved son, my chosen one. That's not the anointed. That's not the Messiah word. It's another one. It just means chosen. Listen to him. What was said when Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist? This is my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. The voice was spoken, Jesus found alone. And so Moses and Elijah disappeared. They kept silent, reported no one in those days any of the things which they had seen. All right, let's see. How far does this section go? This next section is really about the 12, but it's not. So they come down, and somebody else wants a demon cast out of them. But what's the problem?
The disciples can't do it.
They've been asking the disciples to do it. Well, which disciples? Well, probably the 9 who weren't on the mountain.
Right.
Well, why can't they do it?
They hadn't been given the power.
Well, they were given the power, though.
But it's their faith.
Oh, come on.
They weren't.
Let's see, where is that?
They weren't ready.
You unbelieving, verse 41. You unbelieving and perverted generation.
Yep.
So, lack of faith, okay, that's one thing. But then there's the second word. Perverted. Who's he calling unbelieving and perverted? The 9? They're the ones that can't cast out the demons.
No, he's been talking to the other guy that wants him cast out.
But he's been casting out demons from everybody else, so why is he called this guy unbelieving and perverted?
He knows something we don't.
I'm not sure who Jesus is talking to and why, but there's the man, there's the other people who were around, and there's the 12. So let's think about that. So Jesus casts out the demon, everything's fine, and they were all amazed at the greatness of God, verse 43. Everyone was marveling at all that he was doing and said to his disciples, someone read verses 44 and 45.
Excuse me a minute.
Yes.
I believe the answer to your first question was a little bit further down in that verse where he said, bring thy son hither. So everything prior to that would have been he was talking to the guy.
Possibly. Someone read verses 44 and 45.
Let these words sink down into your ears, for the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men. But they did not understand this, saying, and it was hidden from them, so they did not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about this saying.
Yeah, we're not asking this stuff no more. This is one reason I think he might have been talking to the 12 as well, or instead of the man. Because they're like, well, yeah, he's already scolded us for a while. We're not going to ask him this stuff no more. It's not necessarily the case, but could be. Yes?
I know this is kind of jumping ahead, but in verses 49 and 50, just to kind of go along with, well, why weren't they able to pull it out?
Mm-hmm.
In 49 it says, John answered and said, Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him, because he does not follow along with us. But Jesus said to him, do not hinder him, for he who is not against you is for you. So I think it might have something to do with the apostles, possibly their intent, or we also know though sometimes with the people who were healed, that it was those who had the faith who could be healed. So maybe the Father came upon to be healed, but he was kind of doubting it. So it could be a fault on multiple people who they didn't have the faith.
Yeah. Could be a lot of things going on, because he's going to curse Chorazin and Bethsaida and other people later. But now let's look at what's in the middle of all this. Someone read verses 46 through 48.
An argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest. But Jesus, knowing what they were thinking in their heart, took a child and stood by him by his side. And he said to them, whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For the one who is least among all of you, this is the one who is great.
Why would they start arguing about that all of a sudden out of nowhere? What's the context? What just happened?
Is it because you only took a few to the transfiguration?
Yeah. Which few? Yeah, which ones? Peter, James, and John. Well, why not Andrew? Andrew's Peter's brother. Well, why not the other guy? Well, why not this? Why not that? This is just speculation. But knowing people and knowing group dynamics as I know them, it is not beyond reasonable doubt that there was already some schisms starting in the disciples before this happened. There's no record in any of the Gospels before the Transfiguration of any argument between the disciples. None. Then the Transfiguration happens, and then all of a sudden they start arguing about who's the greatest. In the Transfiguration is Peter, James, and John. James and John, brothers. Oh, they're the brothers. Well, they're good. And then I don't think it's in Luke, but in Matthew, whose mother asks for her sons to sit at his right hand and his left? James and John. Well, who else is up there? Peter. Well, why them? Peter was up there too. And hey, Andrew's Peter's brother. Well, why not Peter? Well, you know, Philip, I'm from the same town as Peter and Andrew. And then, you know, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. It makes sense. It's just speculation, so I got to make sure that's clear. But we do have, and there's a correlation does not necessarily mean causation, but, you know, it's there. Notice no arguments between the 12 until the transfiguration. Now all of a sudden there's arguments. I think in Matthew there's a total of three. There's two in Luke that I know of for sure, and they're both in Matthew as well. I don't know Luke, Mark as nearly as well as I know Matthew and Mark, so Matthew and Luke. So this argument starts, and Jesus, knowing their heart, does what? You guys, get your heads on straight. Is that what he does?
No.
What's he do?
Does an object lesson.
Does he say, you need to become like children? He doesn't say, you become like children. He says, treat each other like the other ones are children. He says, so Peter, you treat John like he's a child. Andrew, you treat Judas, not Iscariot, like he's a child. Whoever receives, it's an interesting thing, who receives this child in my name receives me. Whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For the one who is least among all of you, this is the one who is great. So treat each other like children, but then there is that secondary application. Humble yourselves. This isn't about greatness. It's not about who's great. It's about God being great and everyone bowing down to serve him. Okay, I'm about to go off another tangent there. So this is directly related to our Sunday night studies. This is really what they're about, is humbling ourselves to do what is best in the kingdom for God and for each other. And it's almost in the hierarchy of who should I look out for the most? God, my brother or sister, my neighbor, and myself. That's almost the hierarchy. And then if you're married, my spouse, and then your children. So depending on how you want to put that. But God is always one, and then brethren is always two, and at best, you are 2A. That's the hierarchy that God gives us. It's in the Old Testament and it's in the New. Yes, Les.
Here, they're still believing that there's going to be a new kingdom.
Uh-huh.
And that's just what this is, who's going to be the greatest in that kingdom. They're wanting to be up near Jesus.
Yep. And there's another place, I don't think it's in Luke, where he says, unless you become like children, you will not inherit the kingdom
of
God.
18:3.
It's in 18:3? Thank you. So it's not going to be the first time that they have this argument. It's not going to be the last time they have it. It's not going to be the first time he uses this illustration. But the second time, he's going to, listen, you guys, if you didn't get it the first time, here's what you need to be doing. So I thought it's also in Luke later on where he says, be wise as serpents, but gentle as doves. Well, that's part of that too. And then right after this, humble yourselves, and whoever receives one of the, where is it? Whoever receives this child in my name receives me. We have this thing with, but master, we saw someone casting out demons, and we're trying to get him to stop. I have never quite understood what Jesus was actually getting at. He who is not against us is for us. Okay, so Billy Graham, the Pope, what's the guy in California? What's his name? John MacArthur? Who's the other guy in Texas? Mr. Smile.
Joel
Osteen. Right, we could keep naming these guys.
Yeah.
Joseph Prince. Yeah, T. Jakes.
Oral Roberts.
We could just start naming these. Like, what about like the guys at The Rock, the guys at Livingstones, all the guys at the community? Like, okay, so if they're not against us, then they're for us. There's a disconnect there that I've never quite understood. I still don't understand it, but it's there. And so at some point, someone needs to figure it out so we can all know what Jesus meant. So we can do what Jesus is wanting us to do in this passage. At the root of it, though, there is this child. There's this innocence thing. So Someone had their hand up. Was it you, Solomon?
Yeah. Didn't he send not just the 12, but some other people as well?
Yeah, that's in verses 51 through 56. Oh, you mean 70?
Yeah,
that's in chapter 10.
Can that fit into this? Maybe he also gave them power, and then the apostles...
He does. He gives the 70. Yeah,
and then the 12 didn't know. So you are not the only ones I gave the power to.
Oh, you mean... Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, let me see. Let me make sure I'm getting this right before I say that. Where is it? Though this is about the Samaritans not letting them pass through. That's what it was. Okay. So I'm glad I looked. Well, this particular section is about they're sending the disciples ahead, Jesus sending the disciples ahead to prepare the way for him to go to Jerusalem. He wants to go to Samaria, and the Samaritans say, no, you're not coming through here. So, you know, chapter 10 to the 70, that could be the ones he sends out ahead of them. That it very well could be. So I think I misunderstood the question. So I'm going to stop there.
I thought you were asking why if the guy that is casting out demons is not against us, then he's for us, or he's with us. So I'm saying maybe he gave some people power to cast out demons.
Well, that's what I'm saying is this specific part is not. They're not rebuking a guy who's casting out demons. They're wanting to bring fire down on the Samaritans for not letting them pass.
Are you asking if people in these verses are part of the 70?
No, because of what he said about Jesus said to him, do not hinder him, for he who is not against you is for you.
Right, and that's what I'm saying is in verse 52, he sent messengers on ahead of them and they went entered a village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for him. They did not receive him because he was traveling toward Jerusalem. When his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire? So Jesus is saying, no, don't destroy them because, where is it? You do not with the spirit you were of. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm in the wrong place. I'm in the wrong place. Sorry. Verse 56, the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. Sorry, that's my fault. Sorry, that's my fault. I had the wrong thing in my head. Good job, Solomon. Thank you for bringing back on track. So now, do you still have the same question, or?
No, you were asking the question.
Yeah, I know, I was asking the wrong question.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Erase all that.
Erase all that. Brad, edit that out. Yes, Don.
When John asked the question, and he says they do not follow along with us, Jesus changes the pronoun and puts it back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, do not hinder him, for he who is against you, you know, is for you, not for us. So I think that kind of goes back to love your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they maybe were trying to get mad at this guy.
Well, where are you looking now?
50.
50.
It says 50. Against you. John asked the question.
Okay. It's 49 and 50 is casting out demons.
Yeah.
51 through 56. All right. Now I see what the problem was. That's, again, my fault.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's deal with the first one, with 49 and 50. We dealt with 49 and 50, except for Solomon's question. What was your question again, Solomon? Sorry.
It wasn't a question.
No question. All right. Then why are you talking?
No, because you said if somebody have an idea about why... If that's why you brought all those guys from Texas and all those guys up.
Oh, no. For he was not against us, is for you.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to make the point. Maybe Jesus gave some power to other people that the 12 didn't know.
Well, God did give power to the people that the 12 didn't know, because when Paul goes into some city in Acts 16 or 17, there's some Jewish exorcists who are accustomed to casting out demons. So there was a regular habit of the Jews of casting out demons in the first century. It's not usually talked about, but it was there. So, and then there was the prophets. You know, there was Anna and Simeon. So I'm sure there were prophets and other people besides Jesus who were doing things. I'm sure there was. He was just doing them all, like, and he was raising the dead. No one else was raising the dead except Elijah, I guess. Okay. So now we're going to deal with 51 through 56. And so Jesus sends people ahead to prepare the way. The Samaritans say, no way, not coming through here. And so James and John get all irate, and they're like, no, let's bring down fire from heaven on them. And Jesus says, no, why? I did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. Right. And they went to another village. Can't emphasize enough how Jesus turns the other cheek here. Who were some of the first people to really welcome Jesus in his work? These exact people, just 3 years earlier. But since then, what's Jesus been doing? He's been raising the dead. He's been casting out demons. People have been coming afraid of him. And it seems that that is the motivation for the Samaritans, is they're afraid, except that the text actually says, verse 53, they did not receive him because of what? It's going toward Jerusalem. And who can summarize that quickly? Why did that matter to the Samaritans?
Because they weren't welcome there.
Because who wasn't welcome there?
The Samaritans weren't welcome down to Jerusalem.
Yeah. Because the Samaritans and the Jews were like, and the Samaritans had their own place to go for Passover. They wouldn't go to, like, why we let you go through here to go to Jerusalem to worship when you should be stopping here to go to worship? There's a lot of stuff going on there. And some of the first places where the disciples went after Acts 2 was to where? After Acts 2, the first disciples, they leave. They're scattered in Acts 8, and they go to? They go to Samaria, to these very people. It's an interesting little tie-in there. All right. 57 through 62. Someone please read those. We have enough time for this.
And as they were going along the road, someone said to him, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, the foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And he said to another, follow me. But he said, Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father. But he said to him, allow the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God. Another also said, I will follow you, Lord, but first permit me to say goodbye to those at home. But Jesus said to him, no one, after putting his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God.
On Sunday, I mentioned how this entire chapter is really about the 12, with, you know, rare exceptions. You know, the only the three are in the transfiguration, but then they come down and there's something, this argument. And then we tried to ask your disciples to cast out the demons, but they couldn't do it. Well, that's the 12. And then he sends them ahead of him, and the two of the 12 want to bring fire down the Samaritans. And then there's this whole thing with the 12 arguing about who was greatest. And now we have this final lesson in this chapter about following Jesus. Sure, I'll follow you, but. Sure, I'll follow you, but. Now, the first one to me is the most interesting. He doesn't say but. Lord, I'll follow you wherever you go. I will follow you wherever you go. What does Jesus reply?
Foxes have holes, but my mouth
might not smell. He doesn't really have a place that he goes.
Is that a warning or is that a promise?
I think it's more like information. If you're going to follow me and I don't have a house or anything that you will sleep in.
In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, let's look at it real quick. Verse 1 through 5.
For we know that if our earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, we have a building from God, a house not made by hands, eternal in the heavens. For indeed, in this tent we groan, longing to be clothed with our dwelling from heaven. Since, in fact, after putting it on, we will not be found naked. For indeed, we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, so that what is mortal will be swallowed up by life. Now he who prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave us the Spirit as a pledge.
Did Jesus have a home?
Yes.
Well, he did on earth, actually. Where he had Nazareth, where he was brought up. He had Capernaum was his home base. There was a house there that he apparently went to regularly. But the Son of Man had nowhere to lay his head. This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. That's what this little brief section is all about. Jesus could have had a home anywhere. He could have had a home anywhere. But he knew that to follow him means this world is not your home. It's the recognition, one of the first things to recognize. Oh, I'm not going to be here forever. So when he leaves, he says, I've gone to prepare a place for you. That where I am, there you may be also. So, discipleship. I don't remember who has chapter 10 on Sunday. I'm pretty sure it's not me.